Abby, I'm Gloria Baron. May I see that you have quite a list today?
This is our problem.
And one thing I wanted to bring up, I see that you have MPC on your list, heading your list. They called late last week and wanted to get in touch with you, and what came of that call?
Well, the program director asked me if I'd come and speak to the group at noon at college about my research. And I said, of course, I'd be glad to. But I suggested that we meet for 2 hours and instead of one, because I can't begin to discuss things with the students in 1 hour. So if you have a 1 o'clock class, maybe they can, there'll be publicity at school, maybe they can arrange to cut the class, Gloria. And we sort of want everyone to bring their lunch, and we'll sit down on the grass and we'll talk. And bring your questions, bring your pencil and paper, and take notes. I'm not going to try to talk you into a bill of goods that there was a conspiracy in this country. I keep saying this to the new listeners who join us each week. I'm going to try to show you how to read the newspaper and relate it to the past assassinations, backed up with documents and information. But most of all, we'll take each day's paper like we do on this show, or what happened during this week, and relate it to the past. And I want to discuss it with the students in a serious manner. Another point, Gloria, that I think is important because is that the faculty attend. They have enough time. This is 1 week now before we meet. And I'm asking the program director to try and get the teachers from the history, the political science, sociology, to attend at least 1 hour. You see, the faculty over there is avoiding me. And a long time ago when I was doing my research, somebody told me that Mr. Fabrizio was interested in the assassination, and the young liberals thought, oh, wow, he cares. And I said he couldn't care very much because living on the peninsula is one of the top researchers out of a handful in the entire world, and he has never called my phone to say, would you share some of your information with me that I could pass on to the students? It's that lack of following through, the lack of sincerity, the hypocrisy that we're going to talk about the school. We're going to have a free university rap session out on the grass, and we're going to separate the phonies and what makes them phony, or the serious scholar, or the person who recognizes that the young people want answers and truth.
So that will be Wednesday, a week from when this program is going to be on, and it'll be November 10th.
Yes, from 12 to 2. Another thing I would like very much to appreciate, Mr. Leach also teaches out there. He was not interested in my being there or talking to his classes either. I would appreciate any member of the peninsula who hears my voice to try and find somebody in the next 7 days on the peninsula who would defend the Warren Report, and we could sit and rap, not in a formal debate. Anybody from the Navy postgraduate school or from Fort Ord, an officer or a teacher at one of the high schools who teaches history. Certainly this is one of the most controversial books that has been written in our lifetime. And a teacher must have an opinion on it. If he doesn't, and he's rejecting all these facts, well, the students have to ask why. It is a war. It is a revolution. And the students have a right to say to the teacher, what are you afraid to look at? So I would like them to find a teacher or anyone. Now, about 4 years ago, I was at the college to talk about the research that I had been doing for 3.5 years then. And there was a debate on the faculty, and a teacher named Tor Spindler, who's known on the peninsula, was the faculty member, along with a student, who defended the Warren Report. And I don't remember the name of the teacher. Tor attacked. He defended the right of it. Another teacher said it was not accurate. I don't remember the name of the faculty member. It's in my file somewhere. I kept notes who said it was not accurate. Two members of the faculty and two students opposed each other. But Tor Spindler, 4 years ago, defended the Warren Report. And then when they had people come up from the floor to speak, I asked him if he had ever seen the commission hearings upon which the Warren Report was made. And he said no, he had never read them. Now, what are the implications of this kind of thing? This is a gentleman who teaches at the university, who teaches at the police academy, who's a recognized person on the Monterey Peninsula, respectable member of your community. What does it mean that they defend something they haven't even studied? Why are they in a position to whitewash it? Why do they take their intellectual position and hide the defects of the commission. These are serious things that the kids have to know, because in our society where we have so many problems, the problems stem from this kind of handling of information. I have quotations that I like to read and carry with me of Buckminster Fuller, and one of my favorite is, "A problem adequately stated is a problem well on its way to being solved." And if you recognize that there was something wrong with the commission, and you begin to go into it, the Warren Commission or the Warren Report, then you may find out what is wrong with our world today, because you're not talking about a difference of opinions of whether the government should be doing one thing or another thing, just like there's a variance of opinion now on whether we should use the testing of that N-bomb up in Alaska. We're going to go into that subject. But we're talking about a president of the United States that was killed. And what we're fighting for and what we're dying for and what we're armed for is to protect a democracy. It's just that simple. And in a democratic process where one man is elected and he is murdered on the street and there's so many discrepancies, then are you fighting for one form of fascism over another? Just be honest. And the turmoil in the children's minds comes from not really understanding what we are or admitting to what we are. So try and get somebody to defend the faculty, defend the Warren Report, or somebody who's read any of the testimony would like to get up and sit with me. It's going to be very informal. Students will come up and take turns and sit with me. And if people can come down from Santa Cruz, I'd like it, or come in from Hartnell, Salinas, anyone who's interested in meeting me and rapping, and I can stay later if you want. And it will give us more time than the 1 hour we have on the show. So we'll do that. Now, I brought in also an article from the New York Times Sunday section by Jean-Paul Sartre, the great French philosopher, playwright, radical, revolutionary, who is fighting always fascism. All of his life he has done it. He fought in the gutters of France against the Nazis, fought against the French position in Vietnam, in Algiers. He dislikes the whole Vietnam War, and most of you people listening know the name of Sartre. And Sartre now is getting into the streets with the people. He always has been there. He's one of the few intellectuals in the world who's been right in the streets with the people. And he is blaming the intellectuals all over the world of bad faith. And this again goes back to your faculty sitting in their chairs. He says at Kent State that the faculty were in line with the children on an anti-Vietnam demonstration. The men wouldn't have shot them down, or the response would have been different. But the faculty sit there and teach that the war in Vietnam is bad, and the intellectuals sit around and do very little with the brains that they should be using. Now, Sartre could make, in the article, he could make a very good parallel to Nazi Germany. And after studying the history of the rise of Hitler, I became basically anti-intellectual. Although I read a lot, I put no recognition into the fact that that makes you intelligent. And the intellectual hides behind the book cover. Sartre is accusing the newspapers of being so controlled, even when you talk of freedom of press, that this is why the masses have turned off from all reading of the newspapers except things that are sensational. And it also explains, Gloria, why the new FM station like yours that allows me to talk to the people is where it's at, because the major networks are run by intellectuals. And the intellectuals are dishonest from the word go. And they'll make a lot of noise about positions and have certain people on their shows to show they're really far out. And given a chance to say something that could help the very people they're talking about, they back down. They play the safe line down the line. And Sartre feels that all of his years of fighting and working for the betterment of mankind could go down the drain and end into a bloody Holocaust. If you don't move with the people where they can understand what's happening and talk to them and get away from the bourgeois concept of the freedom press. And Sartre says the personality cult is on the way out. And this has to be. This is why when I meet with you, when I talk with you, I don't want a following. I don't want you to all follow behind me and say, Mae Brussels says Oswald didn't kill John Kennedy. I want to give you the sources. I want you to tell people. I don't want to be the one who knows it.
And I think your new book
will really do more in that direction, May, than anything that I can think of.
Are you excited about
the book? I'm so excited about this book.
Well, this is the whole thing about the book, Gloria. You know, in the Whole Earth Catalog, the introduction to it, referring to all of you, or most of you who listen to this show, know the Whole Earth Catalog. And in the introduction, it said that the government and the church and other institutions have so clouded the progress that we have made that it is time to publish information that is available about a good life, which is also available. So do you want to tell them about the book?
Yes, you're going to publish.
We're writing it now.
The books, the pamphlets, the literature that is
in my library.
In your library and other libraries that maybe haven't been read.
Yeah, I'm making a book.
And the name of your book is
The Whole Earth Conspiracy Catalog.
Yeah.
It has about 300 books.
So everything it will contain, everything that you will need to know, whatever you want to know about
political
assassination.
Well, we'll put it another way. It won't be everything you need to know. What will be is my library as it exists today. The basis upon which I make my statements, like the 130 books on the John Kennedy murder, the books out now on the Sirhan Bobby Kennedy murder, the Martin Luther King murder, the international murders like Patrice Lumumba and Hammarskjöld, maybe Forrest Dahl at home, and the possibly Whitney Young and the musicians, and all the accumulated literature and the cross-filing system of political conspiracies and assassinations in the United States today. It'll be called the Whole Earth Conspiracy Catalog.
It's too bad they can't see your library like I have seen.
See
them all together one room.
This is why when I say, I want to write a book, what are you going to tell the people? They don't want words. I'm going to say, look, here's the books, here's the table of contents, just like they did in the Whole Earth. They say, well, here's this book. You can dig your well. You can make your bread. You can weave your dress and build your dome. And I'm going to say you can run your world, because power is in the hands of the people who have facts and knowledge. That's another one of my favorite quotations, and also Buckminster Fuller. I have one that says, intelligence should be recognized as a global resource. Thinking is consciously disciplined separation of the relevant feedback from irrelevant feedback. So intelligence is the one resource we have not used. And we're going to use it, and I'm going to try and get this thing moving along. I work several hours on it every day, so that you may know how to learn and see it like I do. Well, we're going to roll along, and several of my friends, I talked to them last night, and I couldn't talk long on the phone because I wanted to get some things prepared for the show. And they said, what are you going to talk about? So I said, well, I think we'll talk about the sex life of the Kennedys. Because let's take a little time out from the real, we're going to the really heavy and serious things, but don't think for a minute that the sex life of any particular person in power doesn't affect that power. It shouldn't be that way, but it is. Now, Jackie Kennedy this morning, through her secretary, has denied the articles that are coming out in London about the marriage contract. A man who worked with Aristotle Onassis for 10 years on his yacht is publishing articles about a contract that was drawn up 3 days before Jackie married Ari in 1968. And the conditions of the marriage contract were what he claimed were that they would occupy separate bedrooms. It also included the fact that she would not get pregnant by him, that they would live in separate dwellings except during the summer months and the Catholic feast. You see the image of the people. I'm going into images later with the Robert Kennedy story, but the image, the happy family, the Catholic feast and the summer holidays, they'd be together. And she would get $18 million if she divorced him. And if he leaves her for some other chick, he will give her $10 million for every year of the marriage, as long as it lasts. And he's committed to laying out other additional money while they have this thing going, like $10,000 a month for clothes, and $7,500 a month for cosmetics and hairdressing, and $6,000 for a bodyguard, and $625,000 for her pleasures and comforts and all the other things which he wants to give her. Of course, her secretary is denying it, but she does say this accounts for their separate apartments in New York and how they live separately during the year. And she can have her freedom wherever she wants it, but they'd be together in the summer. I went through my old articles of October in November 1968, involving Greece, because I watched the overthrow of Greece, as I've said before on other shows, when you're studying political assassinations and the overthrowing of nations or the military juntas that are related to each other, you have to follow them all very closely, and what you read may have no meaning, but it may have meaning. And it, right after the marriage of Onassis to Jackie, Onassis was up for one of the largest contracts that any human being in the world ever got. It was for billions and billions of dollars that controlled all the oil and the resources of Greece, practically, and his arch foe, Niarchos, was supposed to vie for the honor of the world's goodies and shipping and all. The Greek military junta had been in power for a year and a half, since April 67, and this was in the fall of 68 when Jackie married Ari. American government was very suspicious of, on the outer surface of Greece, it was a fascist country. Inwardly, we supported the overthrow, we financed it, we put the military in, the junta in power. But on the surface, we weren't supposed to be getting along very well. And I'm not saying that this article about the marriage contract today is true or untrue, but I do know that Ari, by marrying our Queen of America, could maybe bring goodwill to Greece by having the American on his island and his working, and Greece would be more inclined to give him the contract than his competitor, because he had the bait, and he did get the contract. And it was a very complicated, long, drawn-out thing. But it is fun to keep articles, and I'm going to show the people at the school how to read the paper, and a lot of new listeners are buying papers and beginning to cut articles. And when you reach back, the years go very quickly. Like, you say, well, how can you reach back to 67 or 68 and pull out an article on Greece or these things? If they have meaning for you, if something has meaning for you, you'll save it and put it away, and someday it will come. Your instinct about why it had meaning will be true. Now, there was another thing that I wanted to mention on the show. On our August 18th show, in answering Jack Anderson, he had an article about a 14-page document on Capitol Hill written by Dan Ridey, saying there was a conspiracy to kill the two Kennedys and Martin Luther King. And we spent, for those of you who have this old tape, you will enjoy listening back now, because I'm going to bring that up to date. You can go back to your old tape where I answered the Jack Anderson denial of Mr. Ridey's research, and offered to meet him anytime or any place and defend Dan Ridey, never having met him. The document that was in Capitol Hill said that the wealthy oil people, the FBI, the CIA, the Birch Society, and Dallas, wealthy people in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and members of the Nazi Party were involved in the killing of these men. So in defending Dan Ridey and sending a tape to Jack Anderson, I told everyone on the air to take a pencil and put a name at the very top of that list, above J. Edgar Hoover and above Richard Helms of CIA, and it was a man from Army Intelligence. And I said, write Army Intelligence, this particular name, and then draw a pencil down to J. Edgar Hoover, and then take another pencil and draw over to the name Robert Kennedy, who was the Attorney General. And the reason I did that was that in 1962, when Robert Kennedy was the Attorney General, I felt that the Army Intelligence had information on Robert Kennedy to blackmail him so that before his brother was killed, he would never be able to say who killed his brother. The assassination coup would never be successful without knowing that the Attorney General would not be able to investigate it, because he is over the FBI and over these other agencies. So on our broadcast of August the 18th, out of good taste, and a certain Padua, as Henry Miller uses the word Padua, I didn't mention that man's name, but now I can mention it, because this week in the news, last Wednesday, when we just threw at this show, there was an article, a review of a new book by Earl Wilson called The Show Business Nobody Knows. Well, a lot of you people don't know it, but I know it because I read my newspapers. Here we go again. And Earl Wilson's contention is that the Mr. X in Marilyn Monroe's life was Robert Kennedy, that he saw Marilyn repeatedly the month before her death, and the last words that were spoken probably were spoken to Peter Lawford. Now, Mr. Wilson goes in to describe their relationship, how often they saw each other. She wore a wig and went with him frequently on the Kennedy planes to Palm Springs, Las Vegas, Lake Tahoe. And Wilson said, Earl Wilson said, one did never say these things in print. End quote. Now, I'm asking you if our candidate for president or attorney general wants the image of the family man and the father and husband. He should play those roles. And if he wants to chase around the country, he should have his sex life. But that should also be printed, because we protect people we really don't know. They have a double life that we don't know about. Now, Earl Wilson becomes very defensive of Robert Kennedy's position. And he says, I'm convinced he should be absolved completely of responsibility for the events connected with Marilyn's mysterious death. It would be very easy now that both are dead to concoct a melodramatic scandal. And in my opinion, it would be unjustified and untrue. End quotes. Now, I'm going back to the Army intelligence man that had the information on Bobby Kennedy. His name was Frank Capel. And he wrote a book which I have owned since 1965 called The Strange Death of Marilyn Monroe. And when people would say to me, why don't the Kennedys do something about the assassination? I would say, because Bobby Kennedy was blackmailed. Now, you've heard this on the show. You can look up the old tapes, and I've said it over again, that the Kennedys were blackmailed. And Mr. Capel had believe that Robert Kennedy put people in the position to murder Marilyn Monroe. This is what Frank Capel said. Deny it. You don't have to deny it. You don't have to accept it. People that come into my house and ask about the Kennedys, I show them this book, and I show them some of the credibility of Frank Capel. And I say that there was a heavy relationship going between these two people, and he was the one that Marilyn Monroe was seeing constantly. And the circumstances of her death, I have the copies of her autopsy, and who worked for her, and where they went, and how they were hired, and who her doctors were. And the circumstances of her death are just as obnoxious as those of John Kennedy. Every bit as obnoxious. Now, Wilson is deciding there'd be no purpose to go into Marilyn's death, and I have information from a doctor in Massachusetts saying there'd be no purpose to do an autopsy in Mary Kopechne, that all you'd find out is that whether she was mutilated or hurt before the car went in the water, or whether she was pregnant. Now, these things do matter to the country. They absolutely matter who you're electing. You have to know what kind of people are going to run your country. You have to know what kind of condition their women are in. You have to know if they treat their wives this way, how would they treat you? I think you have an absolute right to know what they are doing. And if they want to do these kind of things, they shouldn't run for public office. They should step down and say, the office demands one kind of behavior, and I choose to lead my life another way. You can't have your cake and eat it too. Everybody ended up dead anyway. And the world is much sorry place, because in order to effect a political assassination where you can kill a president and not let the attorney general in the country investigate it, everyone in the country suffers. We ended up with Lyndon Johnson and Nixon and a whole parade of deaths with our candidate Robert Kennedy, and they were entangled by blackmail. Now, Wilson, in this book, Earl Wilson, goes into the details of her death. And what he says, the excerpts that I've seen from the book so far, I haven't read it, and I'll buy it this week, jive, they seem to connect with what Frank Capel is saying. Now, who is Frank Capel? Frank Capel is a man who worked with Army intelligence, and he's mentioned in the Warren Commission hearings in Volume 15, from pages 709 to 743. He's a civilian expert, a research worker. He works with an investigating commission on crimes and conspiracies. He was the man who, after Oswald was dead, came out with a long biography that Oswald was a traitor and gave codes to Russia and worked in guerrilla warfare and sabotage and terrorism. Frank Capel's information on Oswald was all wrong, and he did give the cover story that you people believe all over the world, they tried to make you believe, of Oswald the agent. The same Frank Capel who did the research on Robert Kennedy and got the doctor's bills, the autopsy records, who goes to such length to get the accuracy of Marilyn's death, is inaccurate on Oswald the agent, the same man. And this thread of people runs through all these circumstances. He was an expert on communism in the United States. He worked for the the United States Army. He had very good sources in Army intelligence and worked with former FBI men. He has elaborate files and does extensive research work. He's a research consultant in the United States for people in high positions. His files go back over many years, and his current files include information he obtains from former intelligence officers and members of the FBI. Now, Frank Capel, the man who gives you the cover story on Lee Harvey Oswald that later they found out was totally untrue, had in 1962 begun an extensive document on who Marilyn was seeing. Evidently, you see, they were following, Bobby Kennedy had a lot of enemies. They were following him for a long time. And he was bucking up against General Walker and Hoffa and making enemies right and left. And with his extramarital relationships going, they followed him. And they could use it in case he wanted to be the president or to blackmail him into a position. So at the time that Marilyn Monroe died, they were following all these people, like her housekeeper, who was supposed to be a psychiatric nurse who came in as an interior decorator and did housekeeping. But there was never any food. She didn't cook or keep house or do anything. And the book is a very interesting book. I'll read you just a couple of pages from it. The introduction to The Strange Death of Marilyn Monroe said, "This is the story of an American girl who was used by materialistic, avaricious people, false friends, and sex-depraved VIPs. And because she typifies the exploitation of trusting and uninformed persons, the author decided to take a closer look at what happens to someone who accepts the plums extended to her without regard for the type of characters extending them. The stranglehold on our country today has been accomplished by using this method in many cases, and it takes great strength of character to resist tempting offers from important people. The persons who decide to play along usually find that playing along includes playing around, and playing around is dangerous when important public figures are involved. These public figures must maintain some semblance of respectability, and their public image must conform to the ingrained American moral standards. Therefore, the playing around of VIPs must be done quietly and privately, and all efforts are made to see the American public as unaware of Mr. VIP being anything but a devoted husband and father. Marilyn Monroe's involvement with a VIP. Is there anyone who doesn't know what this means? A very important person. During the period preceding her death was well known. This important person was and is ambitious, ruthless, and will stop at nothing to attain his goal, which is to be President of the United States." This was written in 1965, and Bobby was going to get there. VIPs with important names assume that they are beyond criticism, and no one will dare mention their names. A martyred president whose whole career was built upon a public image very different from the real man has become the basis for deification of the whole family. Through one of the greatest and most expensive public relations jobs in all history, a sacred name has been created which no one may speak against. Now, he goes into the untimely death of Marilyn and her closest associates and her doctors and the autopsy paper. She died of an overdose of drugs, but no barbiturates were found in her stomach. We could read the whole book someday if enough of the audience are listed. I could read some of the things. I'm just running through it because it's so heavy. Part of the autopsy.
Sounds very much like Jimi Hendrix's death and Janis Joplin's death.
Well,
also.
Yeah, and Mary Capeggi.
Yeah.
But this one, the coroner signed, Mr. Noguchi, who did the same autopsy for Robert Kennedy a few years later, said, "The stomach is almost completely empty, and no residue of the pills is noted, and no refractal crystals, and so forth." They put suicide with a question mark on the autopsy. And this is a copy of it, Gloria. And they questioned about the drugs and why she wasn't tested for certain drugs that could easily just put her to sleep. One drop or so would put her to sleep. No trace of barbiturates in the kidney, liver, stomach, urine, or anywhere else, the autopsy reads.
We'll break right now, May. You're listening to Dialogue Assassination with May Bressel. This is KLIB Stereo FM, Carmel by the Sea.